Hi, I'm Sally Hughes, and this is the return of Beyond the Bathroom, where each week I find out how my guests feel about their own appearance. What kind of relationship do they have with their own face and body? What are their go-to products and treatments? Are they obsessive about their appearance, or is it low on their list of priorities? And how have time and experience changed how they feel about their own face and body? Today's guest is Jane Middlemiss. Jane is a TV and radio presenter and double reality show winner. She briefly worked as a glamour model before moving into TV, making her presenting debut on BBC music show The Ozone in 1995. Her presenting credits have ranged from Top of the Pops to Robot Wars, and if that doesn't show her versatility, she's the only person to win both Celebrity Love Island and Celebrity MasterChef. In FHM's 100 Sexiest Women in the World poll, Jane appeared at 77 in 1998, 75 in 99, and 74 in 2000, so expect to see her hit the number one spot in around 2073. Some 25 years ago, she said the most embarrassing thing that had ever happened to her was getting a bubble perm, and the daftest thing she's ever bought was a pink ball gown with gold mesh and an artificial flower attached. Has she got over the trauma? Has she done worse since? How has life in the public eye affected the way she sees herself? Welcome, Jane Middlemiss. And thank you to our wonderful series sponsor, Clinique, where great-looking skin begins.
I am so excited.
So I'm excited for lots of reasons. We've already got quite stuck into this conversation. I've made you park a lot of it because you are such a beauty enthusiast. I love it. We don't always have guests who are beauty mad, but you are.
Oh, I have to stop myself watching your Instagram page too much because your videos, firstly, are excellent.
Oh.
And your recommendations are like, I trust your recommendations because you always tell the truth.
Yes.
And so I literally go through your videos and just buy everything. And literally my bank account and manager really dislike you.
So how much money do I actually owe you, Jane Middlemiss?
Quite a lot.
When did you first get interested in this stuff? Can you remember?
I mean, I remember, I think we're a very, very young age. I think my first ever sort of like makeup, I loved makeup when I was a kid. I had a girl's world. So I would do the whole girl's world thing with the little doll and I put makeup on it. And then I had a cousin, Mandy. I had older cousins who were older than me. And every Sunday I'd go to my Auntie Olive's, and it's in New Biggin, which is just down the road from where I grew up. And I would go to sit with my cousin Mandy and she would do my makeup and she'd make my hair. And I was a kid, you know, and I loved the whole, and she'd tell me how to put makeup on and how long you take for each routine. But the first ever makeup box I got for Christmas, my own makeup box from Avon, and it had everything in there. And I just used to draw on my face with pencils because it was like in the 80s. So I was like big sort of into Boy George and like really going down the adamant route with mm-hmm. a stripe on my mm-hmm. nose because I was a big fan. So I was,
what,
it was so always
you literally
music.
Had the white stripe?
Not only for one party, Sally. I wasn't okay. wandering around okay. with a white stripe in Newcastle. You'd literally get your head kicked in.
Yeah.
So no. But yes, I was very, very into this stuff from a very early age and also very into products as well.
Like, can you remember your first kind of a product you were really proud to own?
I mean, I think as a kid, it would start off with the usual stuff with the Clearasil. You know, I think it was Clearasil. And it was like so exciting to have a Clearasil because it felt really grown up. And like,
did you even have a spot to put it on?
I didn't have a spot.
No.
But it was just like this thing of like, I've got Clearasil. And, you know, it was that. I think the whole ritual, you know, because I grew up in a mining village in sort of like Newcastle back in the day. And we were incredibly cut off. But there was something about going to a chemist that always excited me. And,
me
you know,
too.
And also always as well, you know, I think in the 80s, you know, I was obsessed with, I don't know if it was Number 7 or Rimmel, and they used to do Twilight Teaser lipstick.
Twilight Teaser was Number 17.
Number 17. So it was this, and they did this electric blue mascara.
Yes.
And eyeliner. And it was, that was where I was at. And I was obsessed. I wouldn't go to school without a full face of makeup and having my hair done.
And would you get into trouble for that?
No, because the school I went to was literally like you could be as wild as possible and nobody cared.
So what were you getting out of it? Did you love owning the product or did you want to look a certain way? Were you inspired by pop stars or were you rebellious? What was turning you on about?
I think it was everything. I was an incredible, I was a rebel. So I just wanted to be grown up. I didn't want to be where I was. I wanted to move to London and I was not listening to anybody at school. So if they told me I couldn't wear makeup, I'd just wear more. You know, it was like that. Nobody told me that. But I think when I was young, all I wanted was to be an adult. And you know, it was that thing of, you know, it was the 80s. And so, you know, I was 15 and I looked 35 because we all did.
Yeah.
You know, we all had perms and we all wore stack loads of makeup and we dressed like, you know, we were extras from Dynasty when we went clubbing. And I loved it. It was so exciting.
It was part of your fake ID almost, wasn't it? Your outfit and your makeup.
Yes. And it was part of that, the whole ritual of getting dressed, which, you know, getting dressed for going out is a very, very different experience from getting dressed to going to school back then, you know, or getting dressed and sort of like just going to the shops. I would spend hours back then getting dressed. And it was all about, you know, the hair had to be perfect, the fake nails were on, the makeup had to be perfect. And it was, you know, I mean, I must be partially responsible for a hole in the ozone layer because of how much hairspray I used back then. I mean,
it's also what you're talking about, the kind of getting ready for ages and hair having to be perfect. It's also a really big part of working class culture.
Completely.
And also it's a really big part of Northeast culture.
Yes.
And so what were the women around you doing? They must have been doing roughly the same thing, right?
Exactly the same. I mean, because that you've hit the nail on the head. You know, I think it is part of, you know, if you grow up working class, there's a big thing about going out and you've got your Sunday best on and you put your best foot forward.
Living for the weekend.
Because you're living for the weekend. You know, life is hard and life was hard back then. So this is the thing. But especially, you know, the Northeast, there's something about Newcastle where everybody else, and I know you're from Wales, and I think it's a very similar.
It's similar, yeah.
You know, I think there was something about Newcastle where there was a sort of music movement in every other place. You know, Manchester had all this sort of like, you know, they had the Hacienda kicking off. They had all this sort of like Stone Roses going on every single
Joy Division. Even Take That, you know, there was a subculture.
Like Liverpool had all that sort of post-punk, you know, Echo and the Bunnymen and all the, you know, Frankie Goes to Hollywood. There was always something in these working class towns. Newcastle, flat. Because Newcastle was always a hotbed for partying. It was always you went out and you got hammered.
Yeah.
Basically, that was it. And also back in the 80s, I think I always looked to the side of the glamour side. So I was always looking for, because, you know, the 80s were glamorous. Yeah. It was all dress up. You know, it was all make-believe. You could have this mundane life and yet at the weekend you were this other character who walked around in like huge diamante earrings and, you know.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I had the best outfit.
Did you used to have the brooch on the top of your shirt? You know, the diamante brooch on top of your shirt as though you were like royalty or something.
I had the brooch on top of the shirt, right? And I used to wear a shirt and it was like a silk grey shirt I had. And I had my dad's belt around my waist.
Yeah.
And then on the bottom, I would go to the ballet shop and I would wear ballet tights that didn't have any feet as leggings because they were shiny and nobody else wore them.
Yeah.
And high heels, obviously.
Yeah.
But it was, and of course, you know, it's Newcastle, you don't wear a coat. But I would go out in, can you remember the Hunza dresses?
The kind of seersucker,
it's
stretchy.
It's seersucker, but it's stretchy.
A bit Pretty Woman, like the Pretty Woman mini dress.
Exactly. Yeah. I had a dress very similar to Pretty Woman. It had no sides and it just had a big silver buckle and it was white.
Sounds really flattering.
It was literally terrible. And I used to wear that with like a little bolero, like denim jacket that had silver tassels.
I love the thought you put on that dress and thought, what this outfit needs is an additional bolero.
Sally, I would go out in that outfit and think I was literally Cindy Crawford.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
I literally thought I looked like Susanna Hoffs from the Bangles.
Yeah.
It was like completely delusional.
And so when you moved, I know you moved briefly into modelling.
Yes.
Did you have a sense? Well, I suppose you've just answered it. You felt like Cindy Crawford. You must have had a sense that you looked pretty good. You scrubbed up.
The really weird thing about that is I think everybody else told me that I had a sense of that was what I was, that I had this thing and it was my looks and that's what I had to lead with.
And how was that communicated to you? Did you always just get that?
I always got that. I think from my mum, and I think I always got that, you know, it was sort of cultural in a way.
Yeah.
You know, it was almost cultural because, you know, everything was so cut off. You know, the feminist movement hadn't quite reached certain parts of the UK at that point.
Sure.
And so it was, especially for working class women, it was, you know, you bag a block and you get married and that's what you do.
And whereas that was your power.
That was your power. And whereas I always wanted to work, and so the message that I had got was your looks are your thing.
Yeah.
But weirdly, I never felt attractive. And yet I knew that there was this thing. It's so paradoxical in my brain that...
It sounds like you're a bit outside of yourself.
Yes, completely. And it's taken me so many years to sort of put those two things together and become comfortable in my skin, because there was, it was almost, you know, I think I had been, my looks were always, because I looked a certain way, I wasn't liked by older girls. And so there was a jealousy. So I think I was a little bit scared. Does that make sense?
It totally makes sense. It sounds a bit like you kind of, you mentioned before that you just wanted to be an adult, you just wanted to work, you just wanted to go away. So did you, on a personal level, see modelling more as a way out?
Yes, that was my way out. I've always described it as, you know, I think blokes that grew up at that time, if they wanted a way out, they were going to boxing. And I think, you know, there was a certain type of modelling that you could go into. And I think that was what I did. And, you know, that was my way out.
So like a bit of Page Three.
Teenage Page Three girl.
Yeah.
You know, and so...
How old?
19.
Wow.
19.
What do you think about that now?
Do you know what? It's taken me years to get to the point where I can put my arms around myself and say, I've got you. I felt ashamed about it for many years. When I started doing TV, you know, I wouldn't wear skirts on telly for a long time, and I really tried to underplay it. But I think I think you get to a certain age and, you know, I've done a lot of work on myself, and I think I look back on that and I think, of course I did that. Yeah. You know, of course I did that. It's the one thing that was going to piss off everybody that told me I was never going to be able to do anything and also get attention, you know, which is what I think, you know, I thought was going to be the thing. And you know, I think it's taken me this long to put my arms around myself and go, I've got you.
It's so you were a baby.
I was a kid. And you know, I was an absolute kid. And now when I look at, I don't look at the Page Three pictures, but I've got pictures of me at that time and I see this child, you know, and I thought that I was so grown up. And sometimes I think if you have a past that has got some things in it, I think sometimes, you know, people will use that to weaponize.
For sure.
And literally try and put all of your achievements down because they're like, yeah, but you're
just that.
And it's really odd that we live in a society where, as women, we are still unable to turn up and own our sexual power in a way that is authentic, because a bloke wouldn't get said.
No, of course not.
And it's really bizarre that, you know, I think there is some sort of shame carried over around female sexuality.
Sounds like a big part of that was that you were slightly disconnected from your own
body. I was massively
like
disconnected.
There was you over here and your body over there.
Completely disconnected. I was completely, you know, there was two completely different things. No, completely disconnected. And it's taken me a long time to sort of come into line with that.
And so did you have a sense, I must do something that's a bit more worthwhile, that looks better for me?
No.
That is more respectable?
No, not at all. It just got really boring. There's only, you know, I'm intelligent. And I think, you know, it got to the point where I just was bored. I was bored.
What's boring about it? I mean, I've been on a million shoots. I know why it's boring, but I'd be interested to know.
You literally got no voice. You've got absolutely no voice. You've got no voice, no power, and nobody's interested in anything you've got to say apart from how you look. It's ultimately vacuous and it leaves you feeling empty. Because if you're just judged on that, it's nothing.
You've talked several times about your struggle throughout your life with anxiety.
Mm.
Had that already kicked in at this point? Was it a feature in your life?
Yeah, massively. I mean, I think from a very early age, I had issues with anxiety. Nobody talked about that then.
No, I mean, it wasn't a thing.
It wasn't a thing.
No.
You know, you just got on with it.
Yeah.
And I was always afraid to talk about that because, you know, I think I was afraid to talk about that because I remember back in the day, you know, like that type of parenting. And it was like, you know, they would say, oh, she's bad with her nerves. And it's like, it's almost like the shame like gets passed down like that. And I never was able to manage the anxiety I felt.
So how would that anxiety show up for you? In what sort of situations and how?
Like, I would be afraid of irrational things, of being sort of, I would just get really scared of irrational things, and sort of my mind would go out of control and fixate on things. And so it would be more that sort of thing. And it would be more around sort of, you know, there was somebody outside staring in my window. You know, it was things like
so
this.
So feelings of paranoia.
Yes. And so it was things like, you know, it was, and I think because I didn't understand, I think nobody taught me how to have feelings. And I think, you know, I think as a child, when everything kicks in and, you know, you go through that sort of teenage stage, and if you don't have anyone saying, you know, this is going to be difficult and this is what it feels like, you know, it's very, very scary. And so I think I carried that through. And I think also because it was all about for me growing up, and I think I just became sort of, I really, really honestly thought I was a grown up before I was.
Oh yeah.
I mean, I really did.
Yeah.
I really absolutely thought I was a grown up so before I was.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You think you know it all and you know nothing.
Yeah, I knew absolutely nothing. And yeah. I think the brilliant thing about being older is I realise I know practically nothing now, and I'm brilliant. I'm really good with that. I'm open to learn every single day I'm on this planet.
Yeah, I mean, we'll come back to that, but I do sort of feel that the older I get, the less certainty I feel, in a good way.
Yes.
You know, I was so certain about everything
when
I was young. I'm not certain about anything anymore.
Yeah, I agree.
That's okay.
Yeah,
and
I
change
agree.
My mind about things
all the time.
Yeah,
yeah,
and think, oh no, I don't feel that way anymore.
Yeah.
So suddenly, and I know from your kind of looking into your career trajectory, it was sudden. Suddenly, you do have a voice. Suddenly, you break into television. You do have a voice.
That was weird.
However. Let's be honest, it's at a time where, okay, even if the nuts and bolts of the job mean you have a voice, it's at a time that's quite toxic for women, and particularly good-looking women, and particularly good-looking women in the public eye. So tell me about that.
The really hilarious thing about the 90s is, well, you're talking about that whole Ladette thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so the really interesting thing about that time is because I had this past, I thought when people were asking me to do interviews and all of this, that this was a step forward. And now I realize that it was so disingenuous, and it was much better doing page three because at least that was honest.
Yeah.
That was honest.
Yeah.
Right.
That's very
this is what I want you to do. and you're going to get paid. And whereas with the other thing, they were pretending they wanted to know what I thought about things.
Yeah.
When actually all they were asking me was
be pretty.
Was basically, when was the last time I had sex?
Yeah.
And, you know, do you eat chips and drink lager? And can you wear this bikini? And it was really weird. I remember reading a quote from Jermaine Greer back then, and she said this Ladette movement is setting feminism back, you know, 40 years. And I didn't understand it. And I do now, because it was so toxic. I mean, you just have to watch TV from that time. And, you know, when women were interviewed, they were being weird on telly.
Yes. And Victoria Beckham was Wade, wasn't she, on TFI Friday?
They would be weird on telly. Yeah. You know, they were, you know, it was all about, and, you know, all of that Ladette movement was basically, how pretty do you look in a bikini?
Yeah.
You know, and I remember, it was really interesting. I remember being on a shoot, and it was for FHM, and, you know, for him. And so it's always the male gaze. And so it was that. And I remember being on a shoot, and the photographer wanted me to take my top off. So because I had this history, I'm thinking, there is no way I'm doing that. I know that's a pointless road.
Uh-huh.
There's nothing you can gain.
I know the drill here.
I know the drill here. And he was like, no, 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 it'll be good. You'll get the cover, da, 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 da. And I was so lucky, because I was like, oh, I'll get cover. Because that was what it was all about. Mm-hmm. It was all about, you know, coverage, weirdly, when it was uncovered.
And your employers are going to be happy that you're on the cover of a mag.
And
it's the profile of everything up.
And also, that was the, you know, this whole culture thing, this Ladette culture, was basically all about, you know, basically that. It was about being a bloke, but looking sexy, that a bloke wanted to, could have a conversation with you about football, but shag you afterwards. And it was basically that basic. So I remember being on this shoot, and he was like, you know, when you take your top off, and I was like, no. And then he's like persuading, and I was like, should I get, oh, I could get a cover. My makeup artist took me to one side. She went, Jane. I went, what? She went, you don't need to do that.
Good on the makeup artist.
And it was like, you know where the screen just drops down and you
can
just
go. Can you remember which makeup artist
you No, I don't. But I will be grateful for the rest of my life.
I'll know her as well. I'd love to know which one it was.
She did Louise as well. She used to do Louise all the time. She was Louise's makeup artist. And she was amazing. But she literally went, no. And I watched other people do that and go down that trajectory. And I was never comfortable with it because of what I had done. But you see, because of what I had done, I didn't see the two things the same. But now I revisited an old interview. And I mean, some of the questions were horrific. I mean, some of the journalists I had to fend off, and the questions were offensive / abusive.
Yeah.
It was a really odd time. It was a time where they were pretending to give women power, but they weren't.
And where was your mental health at this point?
Can you remember? Oh, crikey. I mean, I think at that point, firstly, the word mental health doesn't even come into it, because, you know, that wasn't a thing that was talked about. I remember when my career took off, it was such a frightening thing, because it was fast. You know, it was the BBC, and it was the only sort of like music magazine show at that time. And it
You're
was
talking about the Ozone.
The Ozone. And yeah. It was at a time when, you know, Britpop and the 90s, the music scene in this country was literally the central,
yeah.
It felt like the eyes of the world. So I was around all of these artists, and suddenly I go from, you know, signing on the Dole and having three jobs at once, which one was a nanny, to going onto TV and flying around the world and interviewing some of the biggest music stars ever. And so suddenly I have to deal with that, but I don't know who I am. And so suddenly I have people writing about who I am. So I'm like, well, is that me? I'm not. So it just added more confusion into the mix, which was a very odd time. I think anybody who, and I've seen it happen, anybody who goes through that sort of mode. And I think specifically when it, I mean, we're talking about a time where there was only four channels, yes. You know, there was four channels. Yeah. And at one point I remember turning the TV on and I was on three of them at the same time. You know, I was literally doing a lot of work. And I think the other thing that added to it is I did not stop working because I think I had that working class Protestant mentality. It was literally, you don't take holiday. Mm-hmm. You just have to make hay while the sun shines. I didn't take a holiday for years and years and years. I mean,
which is not great for the head.
It was not good. And so it got to a position where I think it had to, you know, the wheels had to come off. And they did.
How did they?
Well, addiction. I've talked about, you know, addiction in you know, I'm 16 years clean now. And I think, you know, that was...
So no alcohol, no mind-altering substance.
Nothing.
So what led you to that point where you thought enough?
You don't know what the thing is. You know, I think the night that it happened, I think it was when I stopped working.
Mm.
And that's the bit where it gets frightening.
Mm-hmm.
Because your crutch, you know, because with addiction, the thing with addiction is not the problem.
No.
Addiction is the solution.
Mm-hmm.
Addiction is the solution for what's going on underneath. And what's usually going on underneath with addiction is all trauma issues from the past. And so you're trying to medicate that by doing this.
Because you can't sit with yourself.
You can't.
Yeah.
Well, there's so much going on that you don't know what's going on, even with trauma. You don't know.
You need to feel different.
You just need it not to be there.
Yeah.
Because you're being triggered left, right and center. And so when you're that young and nobody's understands any of this, and quite frankly, you know, most people back then were using alcohol in a very unhealthy way anyway. And, you know, I came from a culture that was, you know, practically alcoholic. You would get stars if you were an alcoholic, you know? So it was, you know, we live in a society where...
Let's face it, that whole Britpop culture was very cokey, party drugs, lots of alcohol backstage.
So much.
I mean, it was really fueled by a lot.
It was.
So were magazines, so was the media, everything was.
Everyone. I mean, those, you know, I've had loads of, you know, the editors of those magazines off their head.
Yes.
You know, it was, and yes. So were the journalists, everything, it ran through absolutely
sure.
Everything. The art world, it was, you know, it was very like that. And I think a lot of the casualties of that era come through, you know, they come through sort of like addiction. You know, there was suicides, there was, you know, people, you know, dying prematurely. And it was because we did not understand what we were dealing with. And I think to answer your question, you know, when did it end? It was when it stopped working. It got to the point where, you know, I remember there was one night I drank and it just didn't do anything. And I thought, shit, I'm in trouble. And the next day, I reached out and asked for help. And that was the bit that changed my life. And I cannot tell you that it was anything I did. People who have tried to get recovery and they came in at the same time as me into, you know, get help, and they are still drinking.
Mm-hmm.
So it's always about, they talk about it being a miracle, but it literally is, you know, because there is no way someone who was using and drinking to that extent can do that on their own. It has to be, you know, other people, they have to help you. It has to be the universe, whatever you want to call it. You know, it has to be something bigger than you.
But to your point about, look, the substance, whether you are drinking like you were, or whether you're doing cocaine or buying too much or gambling or whatever
yes.
it is, because that's not the problem. That's just your
yes.
way of dealing with it. When you quit, as you did,
ooh,
when
yeah.
when you became clean, that's really just one part of it, right? Okay, so you stop.
It's not even, that's got nothing to do with it.
Because that's not the real issue.
No.
You're just getting rid of the unhelpful behaviour.
Yes.
And so you must have done other things to have stayed clean for this long.
So basically what happens when you stop drinking is you realise there's a problem. So, you know, I got help and I went to meetings. And, you know, and that's, I literally just hit meetings and also therapy, you know, so I needed to deal with the underlying issues. You cannot stay clean for a while if you can't, you know, you will go mad. You'll just do other things. You'll mm-hmm. over-exercise. Mm-hmm. You will spend too much. You will sort of like pick up gambling. You'll pick up sex addiction. You'll pick up love addiction. It will be any behavior, you know, you can do to stop yourself feeling. You have to get to the root. And Gabor Mate, I don't know if you know him. Gabor Mate is this, he's a psychologist and he does talks. He is a specialist in the addiction realm. And he's always about, you have to heal the trauma. It's about trauma. And so I always, you know, when I help other women, I always talk about, it's literally got nothing to do with the substance. The substance is the solution. Sure. You have to do the work that is necessary. You have to get to the crux. And that takes a lot of time. You have to give it space. You know, I stepped back from the media for a very, very long time. I went out to India for 5 years and I did work out there with, you know, a guru and all of that. So it wasn't until I got to India that I realized, Jesus, the noise that has been with me since my media career, because even though you don't recognize that people sort of know who you are, it's there. And I got to India and it was like, brilliant. Nobody knew who I was. And it was, you know, and people go, nobody knows who you are now. But, you know, and that's what I like now. You know, I like the fact that I can just do my work and go and just be me without that thing that was following me around. And I think that thing of, I needed to get to the place where I was just Jane.
So how old are you at this point?
I was basically, so I got clean in the end of, no, the sort of my mid-30s. Mm-hmm. So I get clean in my mid-30s. So I spent the first sort of like...
Funny old time, that one, mid-30s.
Well, I think that's the time where a lot of people get help.
Yeah.
And I don't know, you know, I think a lot of people go into recovery at that time. So I got help then. And I think for me, it was, you know, it was a time where I think for the first 5 years, I was trying to have the same life and just trying to do the same things. And it got to the point I had this...
What, so you were just going to carry on being Jane, but just remove alcohol from the equation and carry on?
But you can't really, because, you know, I'm in meetings crying for 2 years, you know? It's like, it doesn't work like that. So you're sort of like, you have to focus. You have to put everything... You have to put your recovery at the forefront, everything behind, you know, it has to go behind your recovery. And I think that I did that and I really, really lent into that and I lent into all of the help and I'll be eternally grateful for the help I got. And I look back now and I think, God, I really needed that time, you know, and I was ticking along. I was still doing bits and pieces of work, but it wasn't until I went to India and I had a point in, I think it was my early 40s, where I had a time in my life where I had had this epiphany of it's now or never, because I had had this yearning. I was always a seeker. And I think part of addiction as well was to get to this place where, you know, utopia or, you know, nirvana or, you know, whatever you want to call it, you just to get away from the chatter, the incessant noise that goes along with being human. And I think, you know, so I always had this yearning around India and I had made a documentary tracing the source of the Ganges and that sort of lit my fire. And I had always been a big into yoga and, you know, and so it was an obvious thing. I put all my things in storage, rented out my place and I went. And I had a one-way ticket. You know, I didn't know where I was going to go. I was going to go for a year. And then it ended up being a 5-year sabbatical where I just kept, I spent, you know, 6 months in India and then I'd come back and I'd be in London for a bit and then I'd spend time in Northumberland. And it was in that time where I deeply connected with myself and, you know, my spiritual practices and also my home and making peace with where I was from. And also, you know, my life in London. And I think that was the thing. But it got to the point with that, you know, after 5 years, I was like, what am I going to do? You know, I've got to do something in life. And I was going to become a therapist because I thought, well, that'll be really interesting. You know, that's one of the things I do. I want to help people. And then I just realized, I was sat by the Ganges one day and I just realized I really missed music. And that's all I missed. I didn't miss being on TV. I missed interviewing musicians and I missed being around music. And I wanted to get into radio again. And that was what I set my heart on. And that's what I ended up doing.
Let's take a quick pause on this episode to thank our series sponsor, Clinique. Clinique believes that great-looking skin doesn't have to be complicated, and obviously I quite agree. Over 50 years ago, Clinique changed the beauty industry forever by being one of the first to offer a dermatologist-developed skincare ritual outside of the dermatologist's office, the iconic three-step routine, cleanse, exfoliate, and moisturise. Clinique was the first premium brand I ever owned, and truly, there hasn't ever been a single time in over 3.5 decades since, where I haven't had something Clinique in my bathroom cabinet. From the original Clinique computer that helped women understand their skin, to today's innovative clinical reality diagnostic tool, Clinique has always led the way in helping you to truly understand what your skin needs. They offer solutions for every skin type and concern, and Clinique's makeup and skincare products are dermatologist tested, allergy tested, and 100% fragrance free. Discover your best skin at Clinique, where great looking skin begins. It's funny because given the beginning of your life, there was so much focus, external focus on how you looked and professional focus on how you looked in terms of modelling and being on the TV. It's interesting to me that what you ultimately, when you were in a crisis and needed a reset, what you steered into were things that are not about your appearance at all.
Yes.
And so you go to India where presumably people are not telling you every 5 minutes how pretty you are. You're not even
Nobody
thinking
cares.
About it. Nobody cares. You're not really looking in the mirror. And
I'm wearing,
you know,
all of my clothes at once. I've got no makeup.
You're wearing all your clothes. you presumably got no makeup on. Your hair's scraped back and all of that stuff. And then you realise that all you really miss is being on the radio, not being on telly, being on the radio.
No, all I really missed was being around music. Music has always been, for me, a sort of almost like a thing that saved my life on so many occasions.
Yeah.
It was the thing that taught me about emotions. It was the thing that taught me about, you know, where I grew up. It politicized me from a very, very early age. I mean, I was politicized anyway. My dad was a miner. But, you know, listening to Bob Dylan, you know, bringing it all back home, you know, I was politicized through music. So I had this intense need almost and drive from a very, very young age to be around it. I mean, I was obsessed with music as a kid, obsessed. You know, that was the thing I would do in my bedroom. I would play records and I would pretend I had my own radio station. And I was, you know, that was all I would spend my money on. You know, I'd spend my money on music and I loved it. And it's really funny that my career went towards TV and it was about looks, because ultimately what I really was looking for was having a voice.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't know that. I really didn't know that until I sort of went out there and I did my first year's training, you know, my first foundation course to be a psychologist and all that. And I just thought, these people aren't messed up enough for me. I need rock stars, you know. They're the people I understand. Yeah. They're properly messed up.
Yeah.
You know, they're the
You want some damaged goods.
I want that. Some proper damaged goods. Yeah. I want people who can't actually communicate on any other level than being on stage. And it's like, and it is, it's like somebody once said to me, and it was when I was in treatment, the psychiatrist said to me, I said, you know, ultimately, I said, and this was at the time, this is a long time ago, and I said, ultimately, I'm quite shy. And he said something that was so profound, it blew my mind. He said, but of course you are. He said, where better to hide than in the spotlight?
Yeah. Yeah. And especially on the radio, Lauren Levern always says that the radio is for people who like showing off in private.
That's so
and it's true,
it's so
right?
true.
It's totally
she's
true.
So bang on the money. I yeah. love Lauren and she's yeah. it's so true. And it's like having your own private world and private club where you can just mess around and be a complete idiot and, you know, just do your thing and literally, but nobody's looking at you.
I wonder if alongside all of this, the yoga, whether the yoga, your love of it and that love intensifying when you went to India, whether the yoga kind of connected you differently to your body.
Completely and utterly.
And learning that your body had other value, other benefits.
I think completely and utterly. I think back then I was so disconnected from myself. And I think the journey I took in India was much more on a spiritual level and sort of like learning that, you know, the body is, you know, basically just a vehicle to get you from through this life, but also you keep it healthy and you have to keep it. And I think it very much became much more sort of integrated as a human being. And I did I did my yoga teacher training and I did all that. And so it was an intense sort of journey into both the physical and the sort of like metaphorical and the spiritual and the emotional. It was a lot of work. And there was a lot of singing Hare Krishna up the mountain, you know, it was great. It was literally one of the best times of my life.
And what does that kind of focus on health look like for you now, day to day? Like, how do you eat? How do you take care of yourself?
I'm a big advocate of you look after the insides and the outsides will take care of itself. So I don't drink, I don't smoke, I drink a lot of water, I sleep well, and I eat well. You know, I eat, you know, healthily. I will have a burger now and again, but I will eat food that I cook for myself. I don't really do takeaways. I don't, you know, and I'm pretty much sort of like, you know, you fuel yourself, but you look after yourself as well. But I do think a lot of my inner work is to do with, you know, keeping on top of the mental health as well as the physical health, because I think if you don't have that, you don't have that. And I think we have to have a conversation about, you know, everybody has mental health to look after. And I think for me, the mental health journey and the sort of like the looking after that, you know, so I do yoga and that looks after a lot of my sort of like calming the mind. And, you know, yoga is using the physical body to calm the minds in order to get to the meditation point. And I think that has integrates into my life in a way that makes me feel more peaceful, more calm and more kind towards myself and more loving, and to be able to actually own that, you know, as a human being, life is complicated.
Mm-hmm.
You know, life is complicated. It's not just about, you know, it's got nothing to do with the externals. If we're focused on the externals, we will never be happy, because, you know, you get the thing that you think is going to make you happy, then you want the next thing. It'll make you happy for like 5 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
It's all about being happy on the inside, and whatever that takes, whether it's a yoga practice, whether it's running, whether it's, you know, swimming, whether it's whatever that is. And it's usually accessing the body to get to the mind, because I think a lot of people struggle in going straight into meditation, because you sit down, the mind's busy, and everybody goes, I can't meditate. No, of course you can't meditate. That's the thing. We don't realize how busy our minds are. So I think it's all about finding a practice. But for me, I really, really big up therapy as well. I'm a big advocate of deal with your shit, or your shit will deal with you.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think there's a lot of, you know, time that I think we waste, you know, being, there's a lot of time in life that is wasted because we are reacting from childhood wounds
mm-hmm.
that are not dealt with. And I think that's what therapy addresses. I think it teaches you how to parent yourself, and it teaches you how to actually, you know, be there. It teaches you who you are, you know, it teaches you, you know, oh, I react like this because of that. And how do I self-soothe? How do I do these things? And I think it's one of the greatest gifts you can give to yourself. And I think it's not talked about enough. I think there's a lot of pop psychology out mm-hmm. on the internet at the minute, you know, just be happy. Oh, good luck.
Yes,
with that.
Yes. Toxic,
crack on.
Toxic positivity.
You know, crack on with just being happy and crack on with, you know, your spiritual bypass. That's never been my way. My way has always been going, excavating what's wrong with foundations and building it from the ground up. And that's the only way for me, I think you can, you know, transcend in this life and have a peaceful life and be calm with who you are and be happy as a human being.
Yeah, no, big believer in therapy too. Amen to that. You and I talk quite often on DM about products and products.
Sally, which colour do you use on your skin, Sally? What would you recommend, Sally, if I need this? I'm like a nightmare.
I'm not a nightmare at all. And also, there are like thousands of people who do that all the time. That's my job. It's fine. It's more than fine. It's always nice to talk to people. But it's interesting because you love it, right? You give off the impression to me as somebody who just loves it, who loves beauty, who loves the rituals of it,
loves
the practices. It's funny because now your looks are not your value in the world. You seem to enjoy it more.
Completely.
Yeah.
Completely.
And so tell me about that. Why do you love it and what does that look like in your life?
I still love the dressing up. I think there's still a little girl in everybody.
You can take a girl out of the North.
You know, I think it's true. Yeah. You know, I'm still that working class kid who wants to dress up and be a princess. You know, there is still that, even though I'm this sort of like adult who's all about, you know, finding my voice and da-da-da-da-da and therapy, blah. There is still this, and that will never go, and I never want that to go. Because
it's a harmless way to self-soothe.
And
it's
also,
a positive way.
It's a beautiful thing to sort of like dress up. And I think it's, you know, I like to actually, I don't do it for anyone else. I do it for me, you know. And I think I do it because I just love the ritual. I love the ritual of taking off my makeup at night, and I love the ritual of then putting serum on, and I love the ritual of then I do this and then I put the oil on, and then I just love the whole thing. I love the whole package. I love, you know, getting my eyebrows done. I love, you know, I love the entire thing that you can just lean into where you can actually just be a princess. I mean, it's literally that ridiculous and childlike and beautiful at the same time, because I think one of the things about getting older, and I think as I've got older, and, you know.
And how old are you now?
I am 53. Anyway,
you're a couple of years older than me.
Yeah, I'm a couple of years older than you. My 50s have been my happiest decade, by the way. My 50s have been my happiest decade I've ever had. My 40s were pretty good. But my 50s, I'm really starting to stand in my power as a woman. And that is starting to become something that is very exciting for me. And to own who I am and to own my past and to sort of like integrate it into my present. You know, it's been really, really enjoyable. And I think, what was your question? You see, I do this all the time.
Well, why?
That
what do you
it.
Love
I know,
the rituals
I know.
Of it? Yeah.
So basically, I think the whole thing, I think as I get older, I think, you know, you said, you know, is it, you know, your looks become less important and, but you're on the radio and blah, blah, blah. But I don't think it's that. I think there is an element of that. And so you can enjoy it more. But I think you become freer with who you are mm-hmm. because you're not as constricted by mm-hmm. you have to be this. And you become freer to lean into the little girl parts of you. I think to become wiser and to become more of an adult, you have to become more childlike. Not childish, childlike. Mm-hmm. So you can access that childlike wonder. And you know what? Opening a new lipstick is a good feeling. But, you know, reading a book by the Dalai Lama is lovely as well. But there's nothing like
these things can all be wonderful at the same time. And that is the joy of it.
And I love the whole, and I'm quite a tomboy, but there's a big girly side to me. So yes, I think same. I sort of like can quite read quite masculine in a way.
Yeah,
but, and I think because I have always been career driven and career focused, that can come across as, you know, masculine, which is bloody not stupid, but there is a big sort of like girly sort of side to me that I sort of I bring out in private, I think.
Tell me about the spice rack. I know about the spice rack, but I need more information, and so does everyone else.
I have a spice rack in my bathroom. It's a rotunding one. Mm-hmm. It's a one that goes round and round.
Mm-hmm.
And
a spinny thing.
So it's got two levels, and it's plastic, and it's got all my products on that I use on a day-to-day level.
So what would we find there?
Should I get my pictures?
I mean, why not?
I've got pictures. Brilliant.
I love how closely you followed the assignment.
I follow assignments. I'm like a little prefect with things like this. If someone gives me an assignment, I will do it. Right, let's have a look.
We've never had this before. Such attention to detail.
It's
marvellous.
It's embarrassing, to be perfectly honest. Right, so on my spice rack, so basically I've got things like, you know, my drink up intensive, Origins, which I would use like if
I...
A classic mask, which is really excellent through the sort of like winter, because my skin suffers from lack of moisture rather than being dry. Mm-hmm. So it's water rather than sort of...
So you're dehydrated rather than dry.
Thank you. Dehydrated rather than dry.
The smell of that mask, that apricotty sort of smell, is so delicious. It's one of the best beauty smells.
But also, I like the fact that you can actually put it on and you can sleep in it.
Yes.
And you wake up and it's all plump.
Plump, yeah.
I just like the plumpness.
Yeah, I'm feeling that.
I'm a big beauty pie advocate as well. I love a bit of beauty pie. I especially love their Youth Bomb Retinol, the extra strength one. Mm-hmm. And I love their Youth Bomb serum. I love that.
Something about beauty pie appeals to the 40 and 50 something woman, I think, is the ease of it.
It's very easy.
Yeah.
It's very easy. And also it's just very, it's accessible. It's sort of like, and it feels like you're getting a bargain.
Yeah.
You know, and there's some really good stuff on there.
Uh-huh.
Really good stuff. I really like that under the eye, you know, highlighter, which is a...
Great.
It's so good.
It's great.
And their brushes are really good. The sort of like the brush for under there is really good. So also I use an oil on my skin at night. So I would use... So basically, let's go to the top rack. I'm going to the top rack.
I love
rack.
This. We're still on the spice rack.
We haven't even touched the side. This is the spice rack, Sally. You've got to be really thorough with beauty products. So I used to wear a lot of like really expensive moisturizer because I'm working class. I think if you spend more money, it's better. Mm-hmm. It's not. Mm-hmm. So basically, I got to a point with this really expensive moisturizer where I was thinking it gives me the buff and it looks nice on the day, but it's not doing anything deep down. So I went to Medicare.
Mm-hmm. Brand.
I'm literally obsessed. I use their moisturizer through the day. The one with vitamin C. Mm-hmm. And I use the Night Nourisher as well. And I absolutely love it. And I use a Charlotte Tilbury under the eye thing because it gives a little bit of lightness. And then I use lots of different serums and stuff like this. But also, yeah, that's all. Elizabeth Hardy cleansing balm. Mm-hmm. That is my thing.
People who love that cleanser love it so much. They are absolutely devoted. It's one of those cult products. If you love it hard.
I cannot be without it. It's one of the products that I will not be without.
Mm-hmm.
And I can be without most of my other stuff and I will intersperse it, but that, no.
You need that.
I need it.
And what about fragrance? You're perfume mad.
I could spend an entire day just wandering around fragrance halls.
Same.
I mean, literally.
I met my husband.
Is it? I think fragrance is one of the most underrated and clever devices known to man because smell is the one thing that sort of can take you back or take you forward and sort of like transcend you. And also it's quite healing as well. Certain smells are quite healing. So
it's also democratic. You're never too fat for perfume. You're never too old. You're never too skinny. You're never too young. You know, it always fits.
Yes, it always fits. I was a big Frederick Malle girl. So I love Portrait.
I mean, I for some reason, and I genuinely didn't come into this with any... information up my sleeve, read this. I would have chosen that for you.
Yeah.
It's very you, I think. I can totally see why you wear it.
And also, I think if there was a fragrance that was me in a bottle, it's that.
Yeah, I can totally see why that would suit you.
Yeah, I really like that. And then I wore that for years and years and years. And then I got to the point where I can't smell it on me.
Uh-huh.
And so I stopped.
I guarantee other people will be able
I can't,
to.
I just stopped wearing it. And then I started going Lullabo.
Uh-huh.
And so I do a bit of Lullabo now. Mm-hmm. So I do a bit of, I've been flirting with that. So I do a bit of, you know, Santal.
Classic.
And then I do a bit of the Rose as well. And then in summer I do Neroli. And then I've sort of like gone to Ormandy Gin.
Yes,
and so I do
beautiful.
That. And also I went a bit Diptyque as well. Mm-hmm. I like a bit of Diptyque fragrance. Tam D or back in the day, I would do
you
that.
You would probably like Ombre Dan Low. Have you tried that?
No, what's that?
I think you would like that. That's Diptyque. So Ombre Dan Low is, you know, the classic Diptyque candle Bay.
Oh,
which
yes.
is rose and blackcurrant.
Yeah, I will like that.
That's Ombre Dan Low.
Oh.
Same.
I started wearing in summer last year. I also quite like a tuberose fragrance.
Oh, do you?
I do
so
like
you
a
like
tuberose.
A kind of whorish, big, of sexy,
dirty,
carnal
yeah. flower. So uh-huh. carnal flower was my very first Frederick mm-hmm. Malle.
I can see
and
that.
I wore that for ages. And I flirt back with carnal flower in the summer. And
coconutty, it's nice and...
And it sort of just sits. It's a little bit too flowery for me. Doesn't sit right. But there's something about that carnal flower because it's still... Tuberose is still fresh because it's a white flower. It's fresh. It's not sort of like overtly, you know. It's not like, you know, irisy or, you know, it's not too powdery. There's something deeply sexy about it. But also I went to the... I think it's called, what is it called? Son something. It's the Diptyque tuberose. I started wearing
Dusson?
That. Dusson. I started wearing that last year as well.
I can see you in that too. Do you know why white flowers are often very sexy, pungent fragrances?
No.
Because white flowers don't attract insects like the coloured ones. So their outfit is boring. And so they have to smell really sexy and strong to get the insects because the other flowers look great and white flowers are quite boring. And
God.
So they basically have to like bring it smell wise.
I think that's a metaphor for life.
Right?
It's a metaphor for life.
Such a great thing
yeah.
about white flowers. They're basically wearing a boring outfit. So they pull out all the stops with their smells.
Do you know what as well? The tuberose smell for me is the one smell. It's my Diptyque candle I always go to is tuberose because it's the one smell that just brings me back into my body.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a flower that's used a lot in India in worship as
right.
well. So there's something about the tuberose that I find deeply connecting to, you know, my practices as well as the other. But I'm going to start wearing Portrait again.
I can totally see you in that.
Oh God, I'm
what
so
apart from it. Perfume is your like, quick, this is going to make me feel better. I'm going to throw this on and I know I'm going to feel good.
I like jeans. I'm a big jeans girl.
Me
I'm a big
too.
Jeans and trainers. And, you know, I recently got back into sort of like buying incredibly well-cut jeans. And I just think... They are the thing for me. I love a good pair of jeans.
Same.
And I think it makes such a difference. People just think jeans are jeans, but actually...
Nothing makes you feel good like a pair of good jeans. And nothing makes you feel worse than a crap pair of jeans.
I agree. And I really agree with that. And
if you're wearing shit jeans, you feel like actual shit, don't you?
Completely.
Yeah.
And I went through a spate of like just going, oh, I'll just get them because it's easy and I'll just buy them. And I was like... These actually are shit.
Yeah.
And they're making me feel shit.
Yeah.
And so I went for my birth, you know, I started sort of like going, hold on a minute, I want this. And I've started building up, you know, your capsule wardrobe, which is all around my pairs of jeans that I bought. Because I think you can be dressed up, they can be dressed down, but also, you know, you can just go about your business and nobody does anything. It's not
yeah,
a thing.
And it's not even about money before anyone shouts at me, because sometimes the jeans that make you look amazing are Georgia Asda jeans. It's not
yes.
money.
No.
It's the time, the soul-destroying time of trying
yes.
on loads of jeans
oh, God,
and looking so
it.
Bad in loads of them, but waiting until you put on that right pair, whether
yes.
they're from H&M, Georgia Asda, or they're from Citizens of Humanity, who knows?
Yes.
But it's putting in the quite demoralizing grunt work of finding the right jeans that is worth it.
But that was what kept me away from, I wore skinny jeans for ages. Yeah. Skinny jeans were my thing. I'd wear skinny jeans with the little ankle boots and a good jumper. Yeah. And that was me. And yeah. I did that for years. And then I just thought, I can't keep doing this. I'm not enjoying this look anymore. But the thing that kept me doing that was I could not bear.
No, it's so depressing.
It's because you try on jeans, and I was trying on jeans, and I was like, I look like my mom. This is horrible.
And you can see your ass behind you. You know, when there's
the
mirror on the door, and you just, you accidentally glance up, and you can see your ass in some knickers. It's so bad.
Who's designing these designing these? Firstly,
men. I would say.
It's like strip lighting. That is
fluorescent.
Yeah. And it's bloody overhead.
Yeah.
You're not going to get any woman buying nout in a situation where she can see her arse in four different directions.
No.
It's just not going
to
happen.
No one wants to see their arse from four different angles simultaneously. And also, the way the lighting is, you kind of get pits of shadow in cellulite dimples. So it's so bad. However, when you put on the good pair...
And you look in the mirror and you go, it's literally changed my life.
Yes, it is absolutely life-changing.
And it's literally a pair of jeans. Yeah. But they changed
my
life.
No, I couldn't agree more.
It's like searching for a needle in a haystack.
Yeah.
It's like searching. And you've had to see your ass in so many different mirrors. And it's like, no, this is, I'm only buying these from now on.
Yeah, it becomes an out-of-body experience after a while.
Yeah.
You have to reconnect with it. Yes, I'm a big believer in the right pair of jeans make you feel great.
Yeah.
A red lipstick, the right pair of jeans, spritz of perfume.
We need to talk about red lipstick.
Well, are you a red lipstick wearer?
No.
Okay.
I can't wear it.
Why do you think you can't wear it?
I look at myself and I look like a weird Victorian doll. It just doesn't work. I look like, you look excellent, by the way, in red lipstick.
Thank you.
You put it on and literally you look like you're going out for the night. I put it on, a weird Victorian doll comes to life and it just doesn't work.
I truly mean this. I don't think that objectively I look any better in red lipstick than you do. Hear me out. I really, really, really don't. I think that the key with red lipstick is your state of mind when you put it on.
Do you reckon?
Yes, I do. If you want to wear red lipstick, you have to kind of gear up for maybe two evenings of discomfort, of thinking everyone's looking at my mouth. Of course they're not.
Yeah.
They're not at all. Everyone's looking at my mouth. Oh, I look like a clown. Oh, I've overdone it. All of these things are to do with you. They are not to do with your lipstick and they are not to do with other people. And I think you push through the pain barrier with it. And by the third time you wear it, you feel great. And there is a red for everybody. Maybe you're just like a blot. Maybe you're a finger blot of a nice muted red. Maybe
I think
that's
more my style. Because I've tried that. I went down the road of the whole, you know, doing the eye makeup like this. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that sort of like slightly gothy, sort of like cool look. It's just not me. I like sort of like very quite bare look. And I went down the road of like red lipsticks and I got obsessed with, you know, the MAC red lipsticks. And I went the Russian
red, Madonna's favorite
Russian red, which is too, loved
lipstick
that.
The Blonde Ambition Tour.
So I did that one. And then but I went through all of them. There was another one that I really liked that I just went through a lot. I think I'm more of a orange red because I've got a yellow undertone.
So more of a kind of Lady Danger.
Lady Danger works better on me.
Yeah.
Lady Danger works better.
I mean, I love a blue red. I love an orange red. I just love red. But maybe you're just a kind of a finger blot red
person. I think I'm more of a finger blot.
And a tissue blot. Tell you what you might really like is the Violette tinted lip balm. There's a red one she does that's matte.
Oh, that sounds nice.
Tinted red lip balm with a matte finish.
All right, DM me it.
Yes, okay. I think I can see you in that. Honestly, it's just a frame of mind. Frame of mind. It's not about how it looks. Because the brilliant thing about red lipstick is it doesn't suit anybody. No one's lips are actually that colour. And that's kind of what's brilliant about it. It's like one of those makeup products that's not pretending that's what you look like. It's not a lie. It's a statement.
Yes.
It's going, here is makeup on my face. I have chosen to put it there. It's not pretending to have bigger eyes or sharper cheekbones. It's saying, look, I've just painted my mouth red. Isn't that crazy? Yeah. And that's what's so brilliant about it.
I love that.
It's so, like, it's a totally defiant makeup for its own sake. No artifice, no pretense. I just felt like doing this, so I did it.
I love
moment.
That.
And that's so great.
I love that. I love that. That way of thinking about it.
I love it. The psychology really of red thing, lipstick is really fascinating.
The really odd thing was when I used to wear it, people used to compliment me on it.
And I think very often people compliment women wearing red because they sort of wish that they had the courage to do it, which is why I always try and say to people, just do it yourself, you'll look great.
Yeah.
Just do it yourself. One of my proudest things is the number of messages I've had from people over the years saying, I never wore red lipstick until I started reading you. I started following you and now I wear it all the time and it's my trademark. And I love it. It's such a screw you to the world. I love it.
I love that. Red lipstick as rebellion.
I'm going to convert you.
Okay, fine. I will hear you out.
What about treatments? Do you ever go for treatments?
I like a facial. I do Vishali.
I love Vishali.
Vishali's amazing. And I use her night oil, her balm at night. After I've moisturized, I put that on every night. I think her facials are just amazing. And she's got these sort of hands that are incredibly healing.
She really does.
She's really healing. And she does my eyebrows. And so she has always done my treatments. I also do, you know, from the inside out, I have like a healer that I go and see, spiritual healer as well. So I do that. So I'm more about sort of, letting the insides, but I would say Vishali, very much so.
Tell me if you can even face it, because maybe you're not this girl. We've had a mix on this series. It's been interesting. Tell me as much as you want to about the menopause.
Oh my God. Have you been through it yet?
Well,
you don't know.
I don't know. I mean, I take hormones.
Yeah, I take hormones. Jesus Christ, I wouldn't be fucking sitting here if I didn't be a fucking, I'd be rocking mess.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know what's happened so far.
When you take hormones, things change anyway, right?
Yeah, and I still have a period every month.
Yeah. Well, it's really funny because for me, the menopause was such a weird experience. I think it was such a, you know, the early stages are the worst. The perimenopause is worse than when you get sort of like through the end bit. The perimenopause, I suppose, your hormones are spiking, then dropping. So 1 month you're fine. And then the next month you're all over the shop. And the problem with it is, you know, I started going through having symptoms in my early 40s, you know, and I'd go to the doctor and I knew it was hormonal and it was a bloke. It was a male doctor. And I was saying, I think it's hormonal. You're too young. And I'm like, can you just check? And he'd go, no, you're fine. And, you know, it's not menopause. And
I mean, that's a tale as old as time. I
mean, you know, my wife's a gynecologist. She said, you know, you've just got to bite a spoon and get on with it. It was literally literally that sort of advice. If you can get through it without hormones. And then I found someone who was a hormone specialist. And I had this, I was doing, when I was getting back into radio, and I was, this is in 2019, I was sort of coming back, worked my way up. And I said, I want this woman on. I'd seen her posts and she does a lot about the menopause. And she came on and I said, you know, because the thing for me that was the most scary bit was the words dropping out my brain.
This keeps coming up. Yeah.
It's that was the words dropping out my brain.
As a broadcaster, that's tough.
As a broadcaster. And also, I was thinking, I've got Alzheimer's. I was forgetting things and like words just literally, I've got no word in my head for what I'm trying to describe. And then I'm getting frustrated. And this woman came onto the show that I was doing. It's for BBC Newcastle at the time. She just went, yeah, it's perimenopause. I mean, and it was that simple. I knew it. I knew it. And that was when I started finding out about it. And that was when I found a hormone doctor. And, you know, I was lucky enough to be able to go private and, you know, get that. And I think, you know, Davina has done so much work to try and push that forward. And, you know, there's so much that goes on. Dr. Louise Newson now has got an incredible sort of like space where she's, you know, trying to get these things put through Parliament and talked about. Because, you know, doctors, they're not taught about this. They're not, it's not, you know, it's something that affects 51% of the population and they don't need to learn about it. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's nobody's fault except for, well, it is somebody's
fault.
It's
systemic.
It's mass. It's a big thing. Mm-hmm. And there needs to be more education, because I don't want any woman to go through what I went through, which was thinking I had Alzheimer's and I was going completely mad. And also the anxiety, you know, the anxiety, the levels of anxiety that were happening because of the hormone swings.
About what?
Nothing.
Nothing.
It's free floating.
Just a feeling in the pit of your stomach.
It's just free floating. Anxiety is never about mm-hmm. something. It's free floating. It's just, it's this free floating feeling that you can't pin down. It'll attach to anything, Sally. It'll attach to, you know, finance, romance. It'll attach to how you look. And every single one of us have got, you know, the spots in our armor that we feel weak in. And so when anxiety kicks in, it'll just go to those places. Oh, are we going there again? And that's why, you know, it has been instrumental for me to have women around me who know me really well. So if I'm sort of having a day where, oh, I'm going into this, they can just go, hold on, that's your thing. And you just go, oh, yes, that's my thing. And it clicks you out.
That's
and you just
where
go,
I go.
That's yeah. where I go. And actually, this is just anxiety. And then you can just allow it to be there. And that's part of it. But I think the menopause, it's like a terrifying ride on a roller coaster whilst being holding on to the outside and somebody going, just bite a spoon. It's literally, you know, it's literally terrifying unless you understand what's happening. And if you understand what's happening, yes, you get into the seat and you strap yourself in and you know, you're going to go through some ups and downs, but you're going to be safe going through it. And I think that's the thing. And I think I go down the route of some people don't, and I'm okay with taking hormones, and I take shed loads. I mean, I walk out of the chemist like I've got, you know, a bag from, you know, Sainsbury's full of hormones, because I need them.
Mm-hmm. You seem happy.
I'm very happy.
What do you think now when you look in the mirror and see your reflection?
I think I'm pretty cool, Sally.
I think you're pretty cool.
I think I'm pretty fucking cool. And I like the way I look, and it's taken a long time. And I think I say beauty comes from the inside, and it's about how you feel. And I look in the mirror and I go, you know what? I think you're lovely. And I think that's the bit. That's the bit in life.
That's the bit I hope people take with them, to look in the mirror and to think you're lovely. You are lovely. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you. It's been
heaven to talk to you. I'm very, very grateful. And thank you all for listening. Please go back into the archives to listen to lots more interesting chats on these subjects and issues. And in the meantime, I will see you with another brilliant guest next week. Lots of love. Beyond the Bathroom is written and hosted by me, Sally Hughes, and is an Insanity Studios production. The head of production is Charlotte Mason, the head of digital is Ed Buckley, and the production assistant is Abby Sandler.